are listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 12 noon. Up next, Behind the News with Doug Henwood.
Hello, I'm Doug Henwood. This is Almost Behind the News. Up today, Jane McAlevey talks about union politics, analyzing the UAW's defeat in Tennessee and asking some critical questions about the fast food campaign. And I review Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century. But first, some news headlines.
I'm Mark Miracle with KPFA News Headlines. The Army's top civilian official says the soldier accused in the Fort Hood shooting was deployed for the final months of the Iraq War but did not see combat. Three people died, 16 were wounded before the shooter committed suicide. Army Secretary John McHugh testified today that the soldier appeared to have no connections to extremist groups. The soldier is identified as Ivan Lopez. He enlisted in the Army in June of 2008 as an infantryman and later switched his specialty to truck driver. That's the job he had in Iraq. McHugh says the soldier was examined by a psychiatrist last month and was found to show no violent or suicidal tendencies. He says the soldier had been prescribed Ambien to deal with a sleeping problem. Two Army soldiers have pled guilty in a Southeast Georgia courtroom to fatally shooting a former Army military colleague and his girlfriend to protect an anti-government militia group. Private Christopher Salmon was sentenced to life in prison with no chance of parole after he pled guilty to malice murder charges. Sergeant Anthony Peden also pled guilty, but will be sentenced at a later date. The White House says a Cuban Twitter communications network created by the U.S. government was not a development program, or was a development program, and not a covert operation. Spokesman Jay Carney says he's not aware of individuals in the White House who were aware of the program, but he also says President Barack Obama does support efforts to expand communications in Cuba. The Associated Press has learned that the communications network was built by the Aid for International Development at the State Department with secret shell companies and financed through foreign banks. Israel's chief negotiator with the Palestinians says it will not release the fourth batch of Palestinian prisoners it promised because of the Palestinians' push for recognition at the United Nations. Zippy Livni's spokeswoman said today that the Israeli government had been working to finalize an agreement to free the prisoners when Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas signed so-called letters of accessions to 15 international conventions. Abbas said it was a response to Israel's failure to release prisoners as promised by the end of March. Ukraine's interim authorities accused the country's ousted president of ordering snipers to open fire on protesters and getting help from Russian security agents to battle his own people. But their report today provided no evidence directly linking him to the bloodbath in Kiev. Acting Interior Minister Arsen Avakov also charged that his predecessor employed gangs of killers, kidnappers, and thugs to terrorize and undermine the opposition during Ukraine's tumultuous winter of discontent. Preliminary findings revealed by Kiev's new leadership examined months of anti-government protests that culminated in the deaths in February of over 100 people in the Ukrainian capital, mostly protesters. That violence forced a truce between the opposition and the government, but that arrangement quickly collapsed, and President Viktor Yanukovych fled to Russia in what Moscow calls an armed coup. Opponents of Ukraine's current leadership disagree fervently with suggestions that only police were to blame and suggest some snipers were organized by opposition leaders themselves trying to whip up outrage against the government. Attorney General Eric Holder says the government needs to deal differently with the heroin epidemic than it did with the crack cocaine crisis decades ago. Holder told a Senate committee today that a balanced approach involving treatment, education, and enforcement is needed to confront the country's heroin crisis and avoid mistakes made during the widespread use of crack. Police at that time focused on large-scale arrests and imprisonment. Holder says the government has a small window to prevent the heroin problem from getting even more out of control than it already is. He says specialized drug courts within the criminal justice system are a good way to reduce the prison population of the country. News returns here on KPFA at 4 o'clock with headlines once again. And please join us at 6 for the hour-long edition of the evening news from Pacifica. Now it's Behind the News.
Welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Today, Jane McAlevey will talk about unions, UAW's defeat in Chattanooga, and the problems with the widely publicized fast food campaign. And in an unusual intervention, I'll review Thomas Piketty's massive book, Capital in the 21st Century. First up, Jane McAlevey. Jane is author of Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement, about to be issued in paperback by Verso. The book is both the story of her efforts, successful ones, to organize workers into unions in Stamford, Connecticut, and the tougher terrain of Las Vegas. Nevada is a right-to-work state, yet she achieved considerable success despite a hostile legal environment. How she did it and what lessons might be learned for the labor movement nationwide are the focus of this book. Many of the reviews, formal and informal, were highly ad hominem, or perhaps more accurately, ad feminem. Highly personalized, often misogynist attacks on McAlevey herself. There was little serious engagement with her ideas on how to revive the labor movement. Central to her analysis is thinking about power, who has it, and how organized workers can challenge it. It's a refreshing change both from the timidity of the union leadership and the naive celebration of moral purity so popular on the American left. It's an important book and deserves serious attention, and it's about to come out in paperback with a new afterword. Jane McAlevey. Hello, Jane. It's been a while since your hardcover came out. Has the labor movement recovered in the interim?
Hi, Doug. I'm sure. I think they're still working on that project.
And what are they doing to make that happen?
Well, let's see. The book came out in November of 2012. We've had some significant things that have happened since then. If we work the clock backwards, we've had a relatively recent, fairly massive defeat in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And then most of what's been happening outside of the debate about Chattanooga, Tennessee has been in the world of sort of fast food and retail and what I might call one-day direct action demonstrations. That's sort of been the preoccupation for the last year and a half or so.
Yes, let's talk about each of those in turn. First of all, the UAW's defeat in Chattanooga. Lots of explanations given for it. What's yours?
I think there are so many aspects of what happened in Tennessee that are actually important to the project of rebuilding a powerful progressive movement or left movement and or labor movement in the U.S. It's hard to even decipher where to start, but there's at least a few. So, look, I think the most important part about what happened in Tennessee was a sort of huge misjudgment on the part of the United Auto Workers, both in the U.S. and to some degree on IG Metall, on the big German union, if you look at the roots of where the labor accord came from. But at the most simplistic level, you know, it was sort of like they missed that in the South, in the U.S., the basic position of the ruling class and the capitalist class in the U.S. South has been, we're lucky, you're lucky we're paying any wages after 1865 to any worker, right? So, from the view of the Southern ruling class in this country, they saw 1865 as their big compromise. And
when the UAW came in with VW, this employer that sort of said, well, we're willing to sort of offer you this labor, what's called labor neutrality agreement. I think, first of all, on the part of the Southern capitalists, the Southern corporations, the Southern ruling elite in America, they sort of looked at the Volkswagen Corporation the way that white plantation owners would have looked at, a plantation owner in 1850 who said, we're going to free the slaves of this plantation. And they basically said, we're going to take you out. Like, we're not even going to let you do that, right? There is a commitment in the South, in this country, on the part of the rulers in the South to not have unionization happen ever in the South. It came out through the National Labor Relations Act. It's why we don't have housekeepers, nannies, farm labor, and many other categories of hugely important workers, often people of color, at the time mostly black in this country, even covered under the NLRA. So sort of missing the historic doctrine or moment of what the South is in the U.S. and thinking that a labor accord that an employer offered to a union from the North and from Germany was going to set up a victory without doing a tremendous amount of radical political education with the workers is just sort of a phenomenal, to me it was sort of an amazing thing to watch. So on the one hand, it's terrific that the UAW was trying to go into the U.S. South. Really, I've said several times we should congratulate Bob King and the United Auto Workers for trying to move into the U.S. South, because most unions aren't even trying, really. But the anti-union animus and the anti-worker power animus is really profound among the employer class in Tennessee and in the South. And they reacted in kind, both to Volkswagen and obviously to the workforce. And, you know, Grover Norquist moved in to aid and abet them. So now you've got one of the top strategists in the United States political system deciding he's going to go full on in the attack on the labor movement as it tries to move into the South. And if unions think that we're going to overcome a direct assault by Grover Norquist, we have a lot of work to do. And by the way, a lot of very simple steps like A, B, C, D on how to beat someone like Grover Norquist in a fight like the Tennessee-Chattanooga fight are actually in the book Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, where honestly I lay out this really simplistic model of how we do old-fashioned leader ID in the workplace, what it looks like to identify the organic worker leaders, the relationship that we help enable between organic worker leaders and their mothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, brothers, and everyone in their community to build the kind of movement that could actually overcome opposition by really very right-wing forces in Chattanooga.
Now, what about the workers? A lot of people, a lot of Yankees look down at Southern workers as benighted and backward, and of course divided by race. What's the role of the worker attitudes in the problem?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that, first of all, racism is, as we know, is not only limited to the U.S. South. It is widely across this country, and every employer uses it in every union campaign I've ever had the pleasure of being involved in. So the race card is going to get played by any fierce employer in any union fight in this country, as is gender, as is everything else. So I think that it's part of what happened in the accord on the part of the auto workers deciding to not do house visits, which is where traditionally in a unionization effort a lot of political education happens. That's peer-to-peer between workers who have already decided that they want to form the union, sometimes between organizers, and workers who may be less clear about either their own class interest or what the role of a union might be. A lot of that political education happens away from the worksite, far away from the worksite, and in something we call the house meeting strategy. And one of the things that happened in this deal was that when the German unions negotiated the contract, as I understand it, it was the German unions who, by the way, it was apparently not very easy for them to do this, the more I'm learning about it. It took some real effort in Germany to get the neutrality, quote-unquote, what's called employer neutrality agreement on the part of Volkswagen. And from Germany, I had a friend send me recently, it's a bit like when people in the U.S. think they're doing nice solidarity acts to people in the so-called Southern Hemisphere, and we totally don't understand the context of how we're offering solidarity. It was sort of like the German unions cut a deal that just involved access to the employer's facility, but agreed to not have house calling, because it was sort of like the German unions didn't understand the ferocious anti-union context of the ruling class in the South. So they didn't understand that doing hour-long, hour and a half long, serious conversations where you're actually engaging face to face with a worker who may not understand what a union is or may be confused about what collective action at the workplace might mean for them and their families. So the surrendering of the tactic of the house visit on the part of the auto workers and that agreement was a fundamental problem in terms of how education happens among and between rank and file workers in this country. You simply can't sit inside of a facility where you've always got a layer of middle management, no matter what's happening. There's a layer of middle management. If the top corporate owner agrees to neutrality, you've got middle management in there just messing with the workforce every day. And the idea that some worker who doesn't know much about a union, who's nervous, who's scared, legitimately scared of what it might mean, because there's a long history of, you know, ferocious anti-union backlash in this country, that the idea that they're going to be sitting in the workplace with their managers around having some open-ended long conversation about the history of collective action in America and how workers can form powerful organizations in the workplace, it's sort of antithetical from an organizer's viewpoint. So, you know, again, it's sort of every turn, there were just a lot of problems in the entire approach. And so that's in the context of sort of the workers themselves. I think the vote was so close that had there been a real campaign, had the United Auto Workers, I hear, I'm going down to Tennessee soon to do some actual conversations with people, but I hear as I'm doing my investigation that the auto workers had what we might call a C team on the ground in terms of the staff that were sent in on the assumption that workers would just vote yes for a union. Now, what's doubly interesting to this is that some of the people who were involved in at a staff level in the United Auto Workers' decision to not campaign essentially very hard in the UAW Tennessee plant were involved in a significant effort that was launched in the sort of 1997 or 8 under the Sweeney administration at the AFL-CIO headquarters when we were meant to be changing the labor movement. There was a campaign called the Strawberry Campaign. It's a long story, but the short story is something very similar happened and some of the same labor activists were involved in the theory. So back in the mid to late 90s, in an attempt to sort of restart or kickstart organizing among farm workers in California, the newly reconstituted AFL-CIO essentially purchased a large strawberry farm that negotiated with essentially itself, but with the United Farm Workers, a neutrality deal, and just assumed that a bunch of strawberry workers at this giant strawberry farm would then vote for the union. And what happened was, despite the fact that the AFL essentially bought a farm and then cut its own neutrality deal with a member union, the workers voted down the union. We could never get a yes vote. And the same...
Why did the workers vote down the union?
Because the middle... Because it was the same thing as Tennessee, because the growers in the area sent in the sort of the crew chiefs to campaign against the union, even though there had been a very high-up, top-down deal. So literally the same architects, the same people who cut the deal or who advised on the deal in UAW in Tennessee were the same architects of the deal in the strawberry fields in the late 1990s in the AFL-CIO. So it's sort of like 15 years later, and the core lesson missed, that it may not be as simple as getting employer neutrality in a country where terror is generally thrown around when workers try and form unions, where huge backlashes happen, and where most American workers at this point don't have experience with having a union or forming a union or collective action or what it means to have one or what the employer fight's going to look like.
Or unless you said necessarily have even a good image of union.
Well, or that too, right? But truthfully, most of them have no image. And then, so most of them have no image in this country. South, they may have a bad image. In a farm worker in California in the late 1990s probably had no image. And to the degree that they have an image, right, that's a ton of Mexican folk coming over the border, and maybe they had bad experience with Mexican unions, that's also possible. But it's like, it's just this idea that when there's a deal that goes down at a very high level between unions and employers, that the assumption that workers simply understand, hey, let's just go vote yes, is, you know, it's really bad thinking. It's just really bad thinking. It's, I don't have an equivalent, but especially up against what we think of, I think, as sort of the Southern project against unions in this country, where really the deal to get the National Labor Relations Act almost went down and was frankly only contingent on an agreement to essentially eliminate black workers from the South and most workers from the South from being able to form a union. So the idea that in 2014, you know, an employer deal would just yield us a yes vote was It speaks to the lack of attention being paid to the context and to workers in general in this country. We've sort of like spent 15 years with the New Labor Movement. The people inherited the AFL-CIO after 1995. We've spent 15 to 16 to 17, almost 20 years now, with a mindset that developed of workerless unionization deals, where essentially the philosophy is that workers kind of get in the way of expanding unions in this country. And it can best be done if we just get these sort of accords and workers get dealt into a union. And
I'm speaking with Jane McAlevey, author of Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, about to come out in paperback from Verso.
Why would it be the interest of an employer to sign such a neutrality deal at all?
Yeah, I mean, generally it's not. So to be clear, what was unusual in Tennessee with United Auto Workers is that the German unions had enough power to actually negotiate that deal on behalf of the U.S. workers. So that's unusual. In the U.S., the dynamic we've seen for the last decade, decade and a half of when what we might call new labor, that those are the sort of service workers unions that have been dominant sort of since the change in the AFL-CIO in 1995. What the new labor unions have been sort of prioritizing for the last 15 years or so has been this, you know, what I'm calling workerless unionization deals, which essentially means they run corporate campaigns that are generally run and executed, not interestingly at all, by workers, but by staff who take every tool in the tool shed except the most important one, which is workers being involved as the central actors in their own struggle. And they run these blistering corporate campaigns that I think have largely made it so that there's this sort of high-level, you know, chessboard fight going on between top brass and unions, highly educated, by the way, often white guys, seriously, with big academic degrees who make up the research departments and the strategic corporate campaign departments of the new labor movement. And they do battle, and they block development deals for hotels, and they block development deals for grocery stores, and they take advantage of every, you know, in a way that's good, by the way. Like, it's not that we're against corporate campaigns. It's that what the model has become is everything but workers are involved in getting these deals, which means workers don't understand their power. They don't understand how the deals came about. The deals are often very compromising in terms of what's allowed to happen as part of the unionization process and the forming of the union subsequent to that. Certainly in Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, I talk about some of the downsides of the labor accords that were signed between SEIU and several large employers. And it's not that they're all bad. Again, there are a handful of examples where these can be done well, where workers are involved in executing the fight to win the neutrality or the card check agreement, as they're called. But more often than not, the campaigns simply don't involve workers at all. And if they do, workers are considered like what we call, or they call, I should say, the new labor movement often calls workers now the authentic voice in the campaign. They've become the authentic messengers in the campaign. You know, and they're propped up at press conferences.
That's almost a concept of advertising, though.
Yeah, well, sure. So, but you know, if you're a labor movement that's not focusing on if you're not going to focus on building worksite power, if that's not what you're interested in, which is what's become dominant in the contemporary labor movement since 1995, it's sort of, they're not interested in workplace-based power or enabling workers to build powerful workplaces. In fact, some of these agreements, at the worst of them, have involved rules that say there'll never be arbitrations under the term of the first contract. The first contracts may be already negotiated and essentially settled as part of the deal. There may be no right to strike, no right to arbitration, no access, all sorts of things that would hem in the workers. So that's on the bad side of the deals. Now, there have been a handful of these agreements that, frankly, aren't bad. They can be good, but they take more work, more effort. Workers have to be central in them, and the trend line has been away from it. And I think that the United Auto Workers attempt in Chattanooga, Tennessee, is sort of one of the more egregious examples of the assumptions that get made by unions that we don't need workers really seriously involved in the process of trying to change their own lives. It can sort of best be done by a handful of wizards behind closed doors, employers and unions cutting deals. So
now, the cynical analysis of this would be that the leadership of the unions engaging in these sorts of organizing campaigns are just interesting, adding to their numbers, adding to their dues income, and not really transforming the lives of workers. Is that too cynical?
You know, I'm not, in some cases, maybe not, in some cases, yes. I think that in fairness to folks who think they're doing the right thing, a lot of them think they're doing the right thing. I don't think that they believe they're doing that, though the effect may be that they are, in fact, doing what you're saying. I think some of them certainly believe that they, there's a general philosophy which was begun by Tom Woodruff at SEIU, moved into the Change to Win Federation for a period of time after the split in the AFL-CIO with some of the unions, which was, we don't have the ability to win anything. We don't have the ability to win anything anyway until we get back to like 20% density. And they got numbers for all this on charts and stuff on the walls in the union headquarters. We don't get to 35% to win a lot, but it's not going to be until about 20% density again that we can win anything. That's the philosophy of some of them. So it's, they think they're doing the right thing. They simply don't understand that every year that passes, every month that passes, every day that passes in this country where we are not helping workers understand that they themselves have to be the central actors in the transformation of their lives, that they actually have to learn to fight. We have to help people become less risk-averse. You know, there's a process for how we do this in organizing. And, you know, you use the word organizing, and I want to say I don't think any of these growth deals are about – they're growth deals. They're not organizing deals. So I don't use the term organizing deals. They're labor accords. They're growth accords. But they kind of fly in the face of the long, proud history that we know in this country of what it takes to actually enable and assist workers as they choose to form unions and build worksite power and have a transformative experience in their life. We have a long history of it in the 1930s and 40s in this country. In raising expectations, I frankly offer up a contemporary example. The whole point of the book was to offer up a contemporary example of going back to the fundamentals of enabling workers to build powerful worksite organization at the point of production, which means at their workplace. And then we extended the model in a challenge to sort of conventional social movement unionism, which there's lots of debate about, and I'm right in that debate. I don't see the whole worker model that we talk about in the book as being social movement unionism because, it's not a staff model. It's not a staff-centric model. A lot of what passes for social movement unionism today is like when a union does decide they're going to care about the lives of the workers outside the workplace, it's still disconnected from workers. They just go, like, throw money at some community group and say, go work on housing or something, right? The whole worker model that's offered up in the book understands that where workers learn first is through intense, contentious, workplace-based struggle, where their leadership is developed, their skills are sharpened, their sense of power is developed, and then we enable the workers themselves to then move out into their community and spread their skill and leadership and their newfound sense of politics and confidence in their skills, and then transform bad housing, crappy transportation, and basically challenge all the aspects of how neoliberalism is bearing down on the lives of workers, because it is not simply about low wages. Neoliberalism is attacking the average worker in this country in every single direction. So the labor movement has to enable workers to fight back with, like, every tool in the tool shed, in the workplace, in the community, and combine the fight. So it's like one giant class fight that helps people remember there's a 1% and then there's the rest of us. And the model that we did in Tennessee is the complete opposite of that. And these sort of growth deals are the opposite of that. And, you know, for the skeptics who say, well, it just can't be done anymore, I am so really tired of people talking about the fact that workers in America aren't ready to engage in a fight, because they are. And what Raising Expectations showed is that in campaigns that were run between the late 1990s and the latter part of the first decade of this new century, thousands of workers in multiple states, using a model that was much more germane to the 1930s style of unionization, a CIO infused model of unionization, whole hospital, cross-class, across ethnicities, there's no shortage of workers that we met anywhere I went in this country who weren't ready to actually, once they sort of understood, oh, this is how we do it, terrific, let's do it, like, rose up, struck, did direct worksite actions, built powerful organizations, changed local elections, won housing fights. You know, the evidence is perfectly clear that workers want to do this in this country. So the problem is how we align a union movement that wants to enable workers to do what I think they actually want to do. You see anger all across the country every day right now.
my inner cynic steps forward again to wonder if the labor leadership, as it's currently constituted, doesn't want to do the sort of thing that you talk about because they don't want a mobilized working class, because it would threaten their status as junior partners or their aspirations to be junior partners or the real ruling class. And if they started doing that, they wouldn't get invitations to the White House anymore.
Yeah, you know, I am, since I've never been concerned about an invitation to the White House, or to any of our headquarters, I guess I don't relate to the mindset very well. But I do think what the union leadership, what the motivation is, again, in some cases, I think that, in some cases, I think they believe they have good intentions. I actually know that they believe they're doing something good. They just don't fundamentally understand. In some cases, you're definitely right. They definitely do not want to have a mobilized base that might throw them out of office, that might challenge them, that might make the workers appear unmanageable to the employer who's trying to sit down with the union leader and cut a deal. I think that part of why raising expectations matters is because what I hope is happening seems to be happening, at least from my discussions with many folks across the country, which is that it's a tool for rank and file workers to read how to make some basic demands about changes to help democratize their union, starting with things like big, open, transparent negotiations, where every worker has the right to come in and understand what the collective bargaining process is and engage in the collective bargaining process. So, you know, why they're doing it, you know, I think there's a lot of ink being addressed on that question. But I think it's going to take workers sort of rising up and pressure being applied through all sorts of organizations this country to help enable workers to both take control of their unions and to build a sort of smarter labor movement, a real new labor movement that's going to be in some ways a return to a much older style of unionism which existed in the 1930s in America. And, you know, the union I was trained by, 1199, New England, in fact had that tradition and in some ways wasn't destroyed by McCarthyism in the same way many other progressive and left unions were. Because as I'm doing the history lessons, now that I have time to think a little bit and I'm not running campaigns, you know, 1199 was not significant enough of a union to be a real target of McCarthyism. It was basically coming of age during that period in New York City in a safer space. And so the people who were in the union weren't run out the way they were in other unions. And you know, so I'm a direct descendant. I'm like a direct third descendant in a lineage of people who were trained in a very militant kind of a tradition in the labor movement that was about workplace power and starting with enabling workers to take control of their lives. And we do that by helping identify the organic worker leaders, by seriously doing education and training, explaining how the fight works and what they're going to have to do to win, and then by enabling workers, not doing work for them, enabling the workers to build powerful worksite organization. The difference that we talk a lot about in the book is that we actually extend what is sort of an 1199/1930s style organizing model and bring it into the community in a very systematic way to go at neoliberalism because neoliberalism isn't stopping just in the workplace, right? We are under attack. The working class in this country is under attack everywhere, in their homes, in their schools, in their neighborhoods, on their sidewalks, and at the workplace. So we need a unionization sort of theory and model right now that's like all encompassing and that enables us to like train up a new army and a generation of workers who can actually sort of reclaim a class fight against some really powerful and nasty people that we're fighting against in this country, like Grover Norquist in Tennessee.
And we're running low on time, but I do want to get your comments on the fast food organizing that's attracted a lot of attention, the fight for 15 and all that. What do you think?
No, seriously. And on the one hand, it's like, look, you know, it is in fact leading to some raises. And it's good when people in this country get a raise. It's always good when low-wage workers get a raise, period. On the other hand, it's just an extension of the logic of sort of the corporate campaign model where workers are not the central actors in these struggles, where everything we know about what it takes to build actual worksite power is the exact opposite of what's happening in basically all of the fast food work. We are not going into facilities and identifying organic worker leaders. Some people say, well, that's not possible because it's fast food and they're transient and yada yada. Well, if it's really not possible, then maybe we should be spending our precious resources in different places that are much more strategic in the economy as a strategy to then be able to lift up an entire class by organizing workers where we can actually teach workers themselves to lead their own struggles. So, for example, in hospitals and in schools in this country, where you have the ability to do cross-class, cross-race, cross-skill, up and down, horizontal, essentially industrial-style organizing the way we did it in the 1930s, but in the large work sites that are still left in America. We essentially have almost no organizing going on, new organizing going on in hospitals across America right now for too many reasons that we don't have time for right now, but I address them in the new afterword in the book, which has a lot to do with so-called left or progressive union healthcare fratricide going on among the healthcare sector of unions in this country, right? Which has given rise to the Tea Party becoming the dominant voice in the healthcare debate in America because we can't work our own crap out on the sidelines, so the corporations are just running all over us, and we have no large-scale unionization happening in a lot of the sectors where it should be happening in this country because we're distracted by the idea that getting a 50 cent or a dollar or a $2 an hour raise in select markets for some low-wage workers is our salvation. It's always a good thing, as I said, for some folks to get a raise. It simply isn't a strategy that's going to help us build power in this country to have a serious class movement that's going to take on the 1% forces that are dragging down the entire country.
That was Jane McAlevey, author of Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement, about to be issued in paperback by Verso. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
As a union man, I'm wise to the lies of the company spies. And I don't get fooled by the factory rules, because I always read between the lines. And I always get my way. If I strike for higher pay, when I show my card to the Scotland Yard, and this is what I say.
Some of Part of the Union by the Straubs. Today we've got two old British bands offering commentary on the capital-labor relationship. Next up is me. I don't often do this, but I'm going to read a review I wrote for Book Forum's current issue of Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century. It's getting a lot of attention, and rightfully so. Word is that it's about to hit the New York Times bestseller list, an extremely unusual fate for a massive, intensely serious work of political economy. Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century is published by Harvard University Press. The core message of this enormous and enormously important book can be delivered in a few lines. Left to its own devices, wealth inevitably tends to concentrate in capitalist economies. There is no natural mechanism inherent in the structure of such economies for inhibiting, much less reversing, that tendency. Only crises like war and depression or political interventions like taxation can do the trick. And Thomas Piketty has two centuries of data to prove his point. In more technical terms, the central argument of capital in the 21st century is that as long as the rate of return on capital, abbreviated R, exceeds the broad rate of growth in national income, G, that is, as long as R is greater than G, capital will concentrate. It's an empirical fact that the rate of return on capital, income in the form of profits, dividends, rents, and the like, divided by the value of the assets that produce that income, has averaged about 4 to 5% over the last two centuries. It is also an empirical fact that the growth rate in GDP per capita has averaged 1 to 2%. There are periods and places where growth is faster, of course. The United States in its younger days, Japan from the 1950s through the 1980s, China over the last 30 years. But these are exceptions, and the two earlier examples have reverted to the mean. So if that 4 to 5% return is largely saved rather than being bombed, taxed, or dissipated away, it will accumulate into an ever greater mass relative to average incomes. It may seem like common sense to anyone who's lived for the last few decades, but it's always nice to have evidence to back up common sense, which isn't always reliable. There's another trend that intensifies the upward concentration of wealth. Fortunes themselves are ratcheting upward. Within the proverbial 1%, the 0.1% are doing better than the remaining 0.9, and the 0.01% are doing better than the remaining 0.09%, and so on. The bigger the fortune, the higher the return. Piketty makes this point by looking not only at individual portfolios, but also, ingeniously, at U.S. university endowment, for which decades of good data exist. The average American university endowment enjoyed an average real return, after accounting for management costs, of 8.2% a year between 1980 and 2010. Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, in a class by themselves, with endowments in the $15 to $30 billion range, got a return of 10.2% a year. From that lofty peak, the average return descends with every size class, from 8.8% for endowment over $1 billion, down to 6.2% for those under $100 million. In short, money breeds money, and the more money there is, the more prolific the breeding. It was once believed, in the decades immediately following the Great Depression and World War II, that vast disparities in wealth were features of youthful capitalism that had been left behind and that the thing was reaching maturity. This theory was first enunciated formally in a 1955 paper by the economist Simon Kuznets, who plotted a curve representing the historical course of inequality that looked like an upside-down U. Kuznets' chart showed that disparities in wealth rose dramatically during the early years of growth and then reversed once a mature capitalist economy reached a certain, though none too specific, stage of development. Kuznets' curve fit nicely with the actual experiences of rich countries in what the French call the Trente Glorieuses, 30 glorious years between 1945 and 75, when economic growth was broadly shared and income differentials narrowed. In the United States, according to the Census Bureau's numbers, which have their problems, more on that in a moment, the share of income claimed by the top 20%, and within that group, the top 5%, declined during the glorious years. At the same time, the income of the remaining 80% gained. But in the U.S., the 30 glorious years more like 20-odd years, depending upon how you measure it. The equalization process ended sometime between 1968 and 74, again according to the census figures. Still, quibbles aside, the process of relative equalization went on for long enough that it felt like Kuznets was onto something with his curve. I say relative because these are still no small numbers. The richest 5% of families had incomes about 11 times those of the poorest 20% in 1974, the most equal year by this measure since the census figures started in 1947. But that number looks small now compared to the most recent ratio, about 23 times in 2012. While these census numbers and similar statistical efforts based on surveys of households elsewhere in the world are useful in outlining broad trends, they have a few serious problems. Most important, they don't account for the very rich, a topic of extreme voyeuristic and political interests. Plutocrats do not answer surveys. The Federal Reserve does a triennial survey of consumer finances that makes special efforts to cover the rich, but by design, the members of the Forbes 400 are excluded. For reasons of privacy, according to the survey's documentation. For serious analysis of the serious rich, one needs to look at tax data, which is what Piketty has done. Piketty's study is largely confined to a handful of rich countries, the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, and Japan. These economies have the best data over the longest periods of time. And besides, if you're studying wealth, these are the countries where the moneyed have disproportionately lived. The French data is particularly detailed because the French Revolution instituted an elaborate registry of property. The revolutionary French didn't do much to redistribute wealth. It was, after all, a bourgeois revolution, but they did a lot to catalog it. Most rich countries introduced income taxes in the early 20th century, which made it possible to study the volume and structure of incomes with some precision and detail. But it's possible to journey further into the past for estimates of aggregate incomes and the value of the capital stock. And indeed, much of capital in the 21st century is devoted to outlining the contours of the value of that capital stock relative to income, an effective way of analyzing capital's relative heft over time. For Britain and France, the total value of the capital stock, owned, as is almost always the case, largely by the 1%, whether aristocrats or members of the bourgeoisie, whether it's France in 1780 or the United States in 2014, the total value of the capital stock was about seven times national income from 1700 to around 1910. National income, roughly speaking, is the sum of all forms of income in a given economy, wages, profits, interest, dividends, and so on. With two world wars and a depression in the mid-20th century, the capital stock fell to about three times national income. Curiously, Piketty notes that the monetary destruction of paying for the war through taxes and inflation did more damage to the capital stock than the physical destruction of combat itself. The capital stock began to recover around 1950, but was inhibited by extremely high tax rates in the first post-war decades. As of 2010, the capital stock had recovered to between five and six times national income in Britain and France. Data begins later for Germany, but the pattern isn't dissimilar. A stock of capital about seven times national income in 1870, hammered down to just over two times in 1950, and recovery to four times in 2010. The trajectory for the U.S. is much less dramatic. A capital stock of around three times national income in 1770 rose steadily to five times the eve of the Great Depression, fell to about four times in 1940, but recovered quickly, rising back steadily towards five times in 2010. The Second World War did little damage to the American rich, who largely inherited Britain's empire with the coming of peace and the Yalta Accords in 1945. Many interesting details emerge in Piketty's treatment of U.S. economic history. Despite our distinction as the most unequal of the major economies today, America was a relatively egalitarian place for white people in the 19th and early 20th centuries. But, speaking of white people, the liberation of the slaves after the Civil War was probably the greatest expropriation of capital in history. If one counts slaves as wealth, which grotesquely was how American society defined them from the country's founding through 1865, their value is about 150% of national income throughout the slavery era. But practically overnight, they were no longer someone's property. After that, though, America largely lost its expropriating nerve. Not entirely so, however. Piketty reports that it was politically easier for America to institute the income tax in 1913 than it would be in European economies, given residual populist resentment of the rich. That, plus endless waves of immigration, which continually upset the economic hierarchy, kept the U.S. more egalitarian than Europe into the 1970s. From that point on, though, although the rich got richer nearly everywhere, the U.S. became the affluent world's undisputed inequality champ. It's also more unequal than lots of emerging countries, such as China and India. Remarkably, despite those broad gyrations over the last two centuries, many continuities stand out in Piketty's historical narrative. One is the stability of the rate of return on capital, the same 4-5% annual percentage decade in and decade out. Another is the preponderance of that magic 1% figure, which seemed like a polemical simplification in the Occupy days, but clearly has an actual historical basis. But something has changed within that 1%. While it was once dominated by a population of rentiers, coupon clippers who barely worked, if at all, it is now dominated, especially in the U.S., by a group of star CEOs and financiers who flatter themselves that they're being paid for their extraordinary talents. Economics as a discipline loves stories about equilibrium and convergence. Vast inequities should, in theory, be competed away, as economists like to say. But mostly they're not. Globally, poorer countries should gain on richer ones as technology and education spread and mobile capital search for higher returns makes the poor less poor. That has happened to some degree, but rapidly developing economies such as India and many African nations remain much poorer than the U.S. or Western Europe. In the case of personal wealth, old fortunes should decline and be replaced by new ones, just as manual typewriters were replaced by electric ones and electric typewriters are superseded by computers. But in fact, old money can be remarkably persistent. Yes, we've seen the creation of a large number of new fortunes over the last few decades, a change from wealth's dark days of the mid-20th century. Bill Gates is the son of a well-off lawyer who is nowhere near a billionaire. Mark Zuckerberg sprang from the loins of a dentist and a psychiatrist. They are the very picture of modern new wealth. But despite those new fortunes, inheritance remains very important. David Rockefeller, worth $2.8 billion at the age of 98, is number 193 on the Forbes 400. Overall, Piketty concludes, it's likely that half or more of the wealth of the upper orders originates in inheritance. And although Piketty doesn't explore this, I've long suspected the major force the repeal of the estate tax in the U.S. has been that the billionaires of the neoliberal age, the tech and finance moguls, some famous, some barely known, have been thinking about their legacy. The scions of the second Gilded Age want to see their grandchildren in the Forbes 400, just like David Rockefeller is a ghost of the first Gilded Age. I'm less sure whether they want to see their names on traditional foundations, maybe more of the entrepreneurial kind. But it's clear that the political salience of the death tax is a reflection of a fresh cadre of fortunes of a sort that was long out of fashion. Piketty's book could have done with some pruning. It is original and very important and deserves a wide audience. But even a connoisseur gets winded after 400 pages, much less 600 plus. It's often wordy and repetitive, but it's not in any sense heavy going. The prose is clear, and there's a minimum of math. Piketty, a professor at the Paris School of Economics, has little taste for conventional, meaning mostly American, economics. Early on, he's critical of his discipline's childish passion for mathematics and its lack of interest in other social sciences or culture. He often refers to novels, particularly those by the likes of Austin and Balzac, that illuminate the world of wealth, something you'd never find in the latest number of the American Economic Review. And he takes passing swipes at prestigious U.S. academic economists who generally find themselves near the top of the income distribution and who, not coincidentally, believe that that distribution of income is just and efficient. But the major frustration of the book is political. Piketty clearly shows that short of depression and war, the only possible way to tame the beast of endless concentration is concerted political action. The high upper bracket tax rates of the immediate post-war decades couldn't have happened without serious fears among elites, fresh memories of the Depression, and threats from strong unions, competition on a global scale with the USSR, which for all its problems was living proof that an alternative economic system was possible. As those things waned, upper bracket taxes were lowered, wages and benefits were cut, and capital's increased mobility led to increased competition among jurisdictions to offer a favorable investment climate, meaning weak regulations, low wages, and minimal taxes. All these trends have contributed to the concentration of capital over the last 30 years as wealth and power have shifted upward on an enormous scale. None of these features will be reversed spontaneously, nor will they be altered through democratic deliberation. Several times, Piketty notes the hefty political power of the owning class or improved educational access, as Piketty urges at one unfortunate point. Brushing up the working class's skill set is no match for the power of R greater than G, the rate of return on capital exceeding the rate of economic growth, leading to capital's ever-increasing concentration. Starting with the title, the eternally recurrent specter of Marx hangs over this book. Early into the first page of the introduction, Piketty asks, do the dynamics of private capital accumulation lead inevitably to the concentration of wealth in ever fewer hands, as Karl Marx believed in the 19th century? Phrasing the question as something grounded in the past is a nice distancing technique, as the psychoanalysts say, but the answer is clearly yes. Just a few lines later, he credits economic growth and the diffusion of knowledge for allowing us to avoid the Marxist apocalypse. But he also concedes that those prophylactics have not changed capitalism's deep structures and the tendency for wealth to concentrate. It seems, in other words, that Piketty's own research shows that the old 19th century gloomster had a point. Unlike most modern economists, Piketty at least credits Marx's ambition and profundity. But for Piketty, the main problem with Marx is an unequivocal call for political confrontation. Having described a process of inexorable material polarization, and with it increasing plutocratic power over the state, Piketty remains distressingly moderate as he sounds out some of the political implications of his analysis. A major reason for his posture of skepticism towards anti-capitalism, he declares, is that he came of age as a Soviet-style communism was falling apart, which left him vaccinated for life against the conventional but lazy rhetoric of anti-capitalism. Anti-capitalist rhetoric need not be lazy, and for all the empirical sophistication of Piketty's work, his political thinking is hardly a model of complexity or effort. He mostly aspires to contribute to rational democratic deliberation about the best way to organize society. Still, while such deliberation would be nice, political action cannot be factored out of that process just because we happen to have lived through the Cold War's collapse. It's energizing to see that a younger generation of political intellectuals who were in grade school when the Berlin Wall came down missed the anti-capitalist vaccination. They might be able to take Piketty's data and cause some genuine trouble with it. Because serious trouble, demonstrations, strikes, insurgent political movements is what it will take to derail capitalism's inevitable tendency towards concentration. Short of that, it looks like we'll be continuing our journey along the road to a new serfdom. And that was me reading a review I did of Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century, published by Harvard University Press. That's in the current issue of Book Forum. It's also available on their website. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of the Gang of Four explaining how capital is failing us now. Till next week, bye.
Abunima directs the Electronic Intifada and has helped lead the movement for justice in Palestine for 20 years. His new book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine, begins, The Palestinians Are Winning. Ali Abunima will speak in Berkeley on Tuesday, April 22nd at 7 p.m. at the First Congregational Church, 2345 Channing Way, a benefit for the Middle East Children's Alliance. With two contributors from Gaza Writes Back, short stories from young writers in Gaza. For info, 510-548-0542 or meccaforpeace.org. This event is co-sponsored by KPFA and is wheelchair accessible. Thank you.
time is just about 1 p.m. You tune to 94.1 KPFA Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB Berkeley.